As I said earlier, we had many people from this cathedral attending General Synod this year, but these are the three who were members, that is, voting and speaking delegates. Bob Fernley, who as a lay member from the Military Ordinariate, Ian Alexander and Michael Wolfe, both elected as lay members from our diocese. I will say that this will, I think, be looked back upon as an historic synod in the life of our Anglican Church of Canada, and for three reasons. The first is the election of the first female primate of the Anglican Church of Canada, the Right Reverend Linda Nichols from the Diocese of Huron. The second is that we established within our governing documents provision for a self-determining Indigenous church. That has been a long time coming, and it is now signed, sealed, and delivered. And thirdly, of course, because despite what you may have read in the press, this, I believe, is the General Synod that people will look back upon and say 2019 was the year when the Anglican Church of Canada approved same-sex or equal marriage. So a trifecta in that sense. And I just got to sit there and listen, so I'm going to defer now to those who actually had to do the work on the floor of the Synod. Bob, let's start with you. This was your first time attending Synod, and you had a particular point of view because you were from the Military Ordinariate. I just wonder if you would like to tell us what that was like for you and what some of your impressions were about the way the Synod went and how we do our work.
Good morning. So this year was actually the first year that we in the Military Ordinariate elected our lay members. Before, they were chosen by the clergy nationally out of a pool of who do you know. So I was very lucky to be selected. We did have a very unique perspective. We have a connection through the military to a duty that we have to uphold the sacrifice, which is the foundation of what we do in the military. All of the chaplains and the bishop ordinary have been on tour, and so that's a very personal connection for them and for us. We felt that we had a duty to make sure that with our perspective we were to present a united front as far as how we were voting, which meant affirmative votes on anything that was to do with inclusion matters, you would say, any social justice. It was a very fulfilling experience, and it was challenging, of course. But you know, it's good to take part in the process. You hate to watch it and not be able to say anything about it or to take part. It was good to meet other delegates who had a different perspective than the one that I had. I think sometimes you have a bit of the echo chamber effect where you only hear people who believe what you believe. And it was nice to meet other people and to gain their perspective. It was very long days, as I'm sure you all can appreciate. I was heartened by our efforts that we undertook to make sure that regardless of the decision that was made at the Synod, for any of the matters on which we were voting, that we wanted to make sure that we all were able to keep each other at the table and to walk forward in unity. It was said several times that's something that's very particular to our denomination, is that it's such a diverse array of people that you have in your congregation with many different opinions and deeply held beliefs. And we all wanted to make sure that, again, regardless of what happened, that we would still be together and that we would still be able to be around each other. It's a big difference participating in something which is a highly democratic process, being in the military, with our highly authority-based structure, putting it generously. And it was interesting for us as well because we're a non-diocesan delegation, so we were selected nationally. But yes, it was a very fulfilling experience, and I'm very glad that I was there.
Thanks, Bob. You were all also present, of course, for the election of our new primate, Linda Nichols, and Bob also had the privilege of reading at her installation on Tuesday, and very well, too. I wondered if you'd like to say something about the process of the election, and maybe even your own impressions of now Archbishop Linda.
It was a great honor to read at the service, and the reading I found to be quite apropos. So many different things that the Book of Ruth teaches on, one being the difficulty of fulfilling the Jewish legal requirements concerning marriage, and also of walking together going forward, even though it might be hard, or even though someone might be pushing us away seemingly a little bit. I found that when we were considering the candidates, you might read any of the platforms that were available for us to read in the convening circular, but you don't really know the person in a one-to-one way. For example, Archbishop Linda, she's from the Diocese of Huron, and so that's a very faraway place from us, and you don't necessarily know her. So I found that a lot of the delegates, we were asking each other about any sort of personal insight that we had into the different candidates. I found myself also asking, which of these candidates was the best ally towards the LGBT2SI+ community, because that was the morning after the vote on the marriage canon. It was very emotional, and there was a grim pall over the service, you could say, just because it was a roller coaster. And there was a hearty appetite for change that we were expressing to one another. So there were five candidates. It was Jane Alexander from Edmonton, Linda from the Diocese of Huron. There was Greg Kerr Wilson, who's a Metropolitan of Rupert's Land. There was Michael Ulmer, and there was Ron Cutler. And it was five rounds of voting, and they, as the candidates dropped off, we were left with a choice between Bishop Jane Alexander and Linda Nichols. And it was two very strong choices. Now, after an election like that, it's very hard to see if you can get some one-on-one time with the Archbishop, because of course, after you get elected to a position like that, everyone wants to be your best friend, but I will say that my impressions of her were that she was a very skilled diplomat, which is someone that we really needed in this time going forward, just because of how contentious the vote had been. She's from an evangelical tradition, and she delivers liturgy beautifully. I found her to be kind and generous, and projecting a certain strength and wisdom that will serve us very well going forward. And I think with the appetite for change that we had, that we made a very strong selection, and that she will serve us very well.
Thanks, Bob. Let's change gears and move on to the discussion at Synod. It was wide-ranging and extensive over Indigenous matters, and I wonder, Michael, if you would like to reflect on that for us a bit.
Yes. Thank you, Ansley. It all starts with reconciliation, and that's essentially what the several parts dealing with Indigenous matters began with, is reconciliation. And you don't understand reconciliation, you don't know the need for reconciliation until you know where we've come from. From that perspective, General Synod benefited from a screening of a documentary called Doctrine of Discovery. Now, the Doctrine of Discovery originated in a papal bull of the late 15th century, to the effect that when a territory was first discovered, it could be claimed in the name of the sovereign of the discovering country without regard to the rights of the non-Christian persons occupying the territory, simply on the basis that, in the view of the bull, those persons were not human. One example of the effects of the Doctrine of Discovery was that the indigenous population of the Americas was reduced in number from 10 million in 1492 to 1 million at the end of the so-called Age of Discovery. General Synod passed a resolution directing the Council of General Synod to establish a committee to strategize and guide the ongoing work of truth, justice, and reconciliation, including building and supporting a network of ambassadors for reconciliation from dioceses and regions. One effect of the Doctrine of Discovery was the spiritual harm inflicted on the indigenous people, in particular, the failure of the colonial churches to acknowledge indigenous spirituality, and on the contrary, their insistence on demonizing indigenous culture. These were the central themes of the primate's apology for spiritual harm. The apology took the form of an extensive speech addressed to the indigenous elders present at General Synod. On behalf of the church, the primate asked forgiveness for failing to do the things we ought to have done and for doing those things that we ought not to have done. At the end of Synod, the elders gave the reply, which was essentially an expression of their profound appreciation of the apology, with the caveat that any forgiveness must come from the indigenous individuals who personally experienced the spiritual harm. A significant legislative development was amendments to Canon 22, that's the Canon on National Indigenous Ministry. In a move to further the self-governing Indigenous Church, amendments were passed for it, that is to say the self-governing Indigenous Church, to be able to make certain changes to matters currently specified in Canon 22 without requiring General Synod to amend Canon 22. Examples include the composition of the Anglican Council of Indigenous Peoples, the composition of the annual Sacred Circle, and the ability of the Anglican Council of Indigenous People to create a constitution for matters not contained in Canon 22. In addition, and significantly, the amendment gave the National Indigenous Anglican Bishop the title of Archbishop, and the National Indigenous Anglican Bishop would rank with the provincial metropolitans. There was an emotional moment when the primate addressed now Archbishop Martin MacDonald as Your Grace for the first time, and presented him with a Metropolitan Cross. I should say that the role of the Indigenous members of Synod was also at the fore at the Gospel Jamboree, where Archbishop MacDonald, who plays a mean guitar, by the way, had a room full of largely white Anglicans dancing to gospel music. Picture that. Of course, the developments in Indigenous ministry have material consequences. A resolution was passed affirming the creation of the Judicial Commission, which had been established by the Council of General Synod. The commission would be charged with examining historic and current funds made available for Indigenous ministry at various levels of the church's structure, assessing current funds designated to Indigenous programming, and also assessing broader property questions. Topics for consideration might include salary levels of Indigenous clergy and strategies to move towards parity, possible redistribution of portions of property sales on a principled basis, and increasing alignment between funds for Indigenous ministry and Indigenous oversight of those funds. Ansley?
Oh, you want me to ask another question?
Yes.
Well, it's interesting that you end with money. Sometimes I feel like that's our constant bleat around this place. Does anybody agree? But in fact, I gather that the National Church as well is struggling, and maybe you could say a little more about that.
Too right. A fall in revenues, especially contributions from the dioceses, combined with increased expenses to put the Anglican Church of Canada in a deficit position in 2018. The National Church's audited financial statements for the year 1918 show that overall revenue was down by $800,000, that's 7% from 2017. But expenses were up by $400,000 more than in 2017. The end result was there was a deficit for 2018 of almost $735,000. Now, the decline in revenue was due chiefly to a decrease in proportional gifts from the dioceses. That's the money that they forward to the National Church every year, which makes up 83% of the church's revenue. In 2018, these proportional gifts sank by $519,000. Now, when you're looking at overall revenue of $11 million, losing $500,000 is significant. And it was the largest decrease in proportional gifts the National Church had suffered in a single year since 1994. Effectively, seven dioceses decreased their contributions to the General Synod, and the evidence that those dioceses are struggling to meet their proportional giving commitments. Now, although there is a set rate at which dioceses are asked to give to the National Church, their contributions are entirely voluntary, and those giving less than the rate stipulate that they're not able to do so simply because of their own diocesan revenue and expenditure issues. So General Synod passed a resolution directing the Council of General Synod to address questions about what kind of work the National Church should focus on given the financial difficulties faced by the dioceses. The resolution directs the Council of General Synod to develop and initiate a process to re-examine the mission of General Synod in relation to the dioceses and provinces, including the self-determining Indigenous Church, with a goal to allow the structures of General Synod to best enable and serve God's mission. Another important resolution was one directing the Council of General Synod, in partnership with the entire church, to prayerfully undertake a strategic planning process that will lead to the presentation of a proposal to the 2022 meeting of the General Synod for our ministry and mission within the church.
Thanks, Michael. We were warned against adding curlicues to the first round of this morning because it just lengthened something that I already know is 24 minutes long. But I am proud to say that our Diocese of British Columbia pays its gift to the National Church in full, despite the fact that that has some impact on us. And similarly, that this cathedral pays its share to the diocese from which that gift goes to the National Church in full, despite the fact that we have our own challenges. It's so important that those who can are thinking about how we use our resources to help others. So I'm proud of our church on this one. Ian, you got the short straw, and I'm going to ask you to say a word about Canon 21. Canon is just a regulation by which we govern our lives. So Canon 21 is the canon on marriage. It has undergone significant change in the past. In 1971, it was amended to allow the remarriage of divorced persons. About 6 or 9 years ago, it was amended again to allow marriages to take place, for instance, outside of a church building, and that the table of kindred and affinity, that's people you can or can't marry, was also changed at that time. It's more permissive than it was. So here we are again, this time the issue being equal marriage. Ian.
Before I respond to your invitation to talk about that, Madam Dean, I just want to respectfully correct something you said in your introduction, which is that you were simply a bystander at this synod. In fact, you were literally doing the work of the church at synod, helping in a very significant way to plan and lead and organize the liturgy. We had daily liturgies on the floor of synod and three major services at the Vancouver Cathedral, and Ansley was working very closely with the dean of that cathedral, Peter Elliott, on all of that. So thank you for that.
Thank you.
The marriage canon. It was a roller coaster at synod, and I don't want to bury the lead. So I want to say, as Ansley alluded to, and as the bishop does in his letter, which you'll read, that the failure to pass the amendments to Canon 21, first of all, do not represent the mind and heart of the church, and secondly, are not, despite what you may have read in the secular press, a rejection of same-sex or equal marriage. That failure will not change present practice in this diocese, nor in many other dioceses. If anything, ironically, the opposite seems to be the case, because we heard many dioceses at synod saying, well, that settles that. We're going to go ahead and proceed and ask for permission to exercise the so-called local option. Let me back up for a split second. What are we talking about? We're talking about four legal changes in a legal document to change the wording from man and woman to two persons. Because that is seen by some as a change to a canon of the church involving doctrine, those amendments are required to be voted on at two successive synods, and each time they must pass by a majority of at least two-thirds in each of the three orders of synod, as they're called, bishops, clergy, and laity voting separately. So that's what the rules say. Now, 3 years ago, the first reading of those amendments literally squeaked through only after a technical error was corrected in the voting list and a recount was taken. And since that was a salutary wake-up call for everyone, and in the intervening 3 years, a great deal of great work was done to try to find two things, really: a different way of talking about these difficult issues, and a way on this issue of being able to walk together and remain in communion in spite of legitimate and deeply felt and held differences. We thought we had achieved that. And we thought that in part because at Synod, before the debate and vote on the amendment itself, Synod passed a couple of other things. They passed by 85% a vote to ratify and agree with a set of five affirmations in a document called A Word to the Church, which the Council of General Synod had brought forward. Those affirmations include affirmations around indigenous self-determination around marriage, as other things, around diversity of views, and on a commitment to walk together. 85% agreement. And then, before the main motion was voted on, there was an amendment to the second reading of the motion, which passed by 90%. And I want to take just a minute to read part of that amendment to you, because I think it's very, very important. This is 90% of the people at Synod agreed with this statement. And I quote, "Faithful members of the Anglican Church of Canada have different understandings and teachings about the nature of marriage. Some accept that the essence of marriage is between a man and a woman. Others accept a same-sex marriage. Members are entitled to hold, teach, and exercise either view, provided they recognize and respect that others may with integrity hold, teach, and exercise a different view." That was passed by 90% of Synod. Then, as you probably know, when it came to the second reading of the main motion, 81% of the laity voted in favor, 73% of the clergy. It failed by a couple of percentage, 4 percentage points among the bishops. And that, of course, caused a very great deal of pain and anguish to a lot of people, including many very directly affected by it, others perhaps less personally affected, but deeply invested in the matter. We waited 3 days to hear the bishops speak on the subject. When their statement was issued, as you again may know, it endorsed the so-called local option. And this is the tragic irony of the whole matter, because that local option is precisely what would have been passed had the amendments been passed. You heard the language that I just read. Without that pain and anguish, and without the weird disjunction that we're left with between what is actually happening on the ground in much and an increasingly large portion of our church and what is still enshrined in a vestigial canon. So, that's what happened at Synod on that subject.
Thank you, Ian. You've managed to take 72 hours and condense it into a succinct and I think accessible description. We don't have much time left, but there was a lot of other business at Synod, and I wonder if you would just like to bring us into home plate.
Just a couple of very quick things among all the other business of Synod. So flowing from this failed legislative activity, there was a real move to say we must look at how we govern our church, how our church is organized, and what our rules of procedure are, the membership of Synod. And so the prolocutor and deputy prolocutor, who speak for the laity and the clergy, said we'll do this in the council. And just to make sure that that happens, a number of us supported a resolution that actually instructs the Council of General Synod to take a searching look at our governance structure before the next synod. There were new liturgical materials approved for use, some of which we've already been using on a trial basis in this cathedral. There were many ecumenical and interfaith initiatives, including a new collect for reconciliation with the Jews and an endorsement of a common word, which is a dialogue between Christians and Muslims. There were moves to improve the way we manage our church communications, and a whole host of other things that happened over those 6 days that kind of get obscured because of these big three issues. And just to say, finally, in addition to the dean's involvement on the worship committee, in addition to the delegates from this diocese who became members of Synod, the islands and inlets were well represented and did themselves proud at Synod. Father Martin Brokenleg did a wonderful setup for the dialogue about the marriage canon. Donna Wall led the chaplains group, and I see a number of our chaplains from this diocese who were part of that important ministry at Synod.
So Susan
right here, and Nancy Ford was one of those, as well as representing the diaconate. Jacob Friesen, who many of you know has been a longtime member of this parish, was also part of the military ordinariate delegation. And so I think this, that the Diocese of British Columbia can feel good about its contribution to the national church gathered at this synod.
Thank you, Ian. I'm fishing around for my microphone under five layers of voluminous cotton, but I found it. I want to thank all who were involved, particularly who have a connection here with this cathedral. It's a week out of your life. For some people, that means a week of holidays. And we were well served, indeed. So thank you. We will be available in the chapter room after the service if anyone wants to ask or say anything. So let us... there you are. The church is okay. While they're putting all the furniture away, I will say one thing that made me proud.